This is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann Clark. I'm chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Program, and welcome to our program tonight. Tonight's program is University of California, Confronting Climate Change and Leading the World on a Sustainable and Environmental Path, with our distinguished panel discussion. Tonight, we have Joel Machauer, Chairman and Executive Editor of Green Biz Group Incorporated, who will be our moderator, and he will also introduce us to our panel.
Great. Thank you, Anne, and welcome everyone. Thank you so much for coming. California has long been acknowledged as the leader in addressing climate change, not just in the United States, but really around the world. The state is the home to enlightened politicians that create leadership state and local policies. We've got a tech cluster here that's really inventing the low-carbon future. And we've got a world-class university system that's providing the intellectual firepower to understand and act on climate change. The 10-campus University of California system boasts researchers, professors, postdocs, and graduates who are bringing their resources to bear on one of the world's most complex and daunting issues. And under the leadership of President Janet Napolitano, the university has set some bold goals. So, for example, in 2013, President Napolitano announced a carbon neutrality initiative committing the University of California system to emitting net zero greenhouse gases from its buildings and vehicle fleet by 2025, something no other major university system has ever done. And to achieve that, the university formed a global climate leadership council comprised of scientists, administrators, students, and experts from inside and outside the university, charged with seeking out the best practices and policies and technology to achieve carbon neutrality and to advance the teaching and research in climate change and sustainability. And then there's the academic research, innovation, and entrepreneurship, for which the University of California is already world-renowned, and some of that, too, is being focused on climate change. So all of that is part of today's topic, how a world-leading university is leading the world in addressing the climate crisis. So I have this terrific panel that I'm really pleased to welcome. I'll introduce them both. They're all, you know, by name and titles only for now, and then give them a chance to talk a little bit about what they're doing. To my immediate left is Tini Matlock, the McClatchy Chair of Communications and a Professor of Cognitive Science at the University of California, Merced. Next to Tini is Dan Kamen, the Class of 1935 Distinguished Professor of Energy at the University of California, Berkeley, with parallel appointments in the Energy and Resources Group, the Goldman School of Public Policy, and the Department of Nuclear Engineering. And in his spare time, he's the first Environment and Climate Partnership for America's fellow appointed by Secretary of State Clinton in April 2010. And prior to that, or maybe it was alongside that, I've lost track, served as the World Bank's Chief Technical Specialist for Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency. I think that sort of already sort of talks about the impact that the university is having in the world. And then at the far end is Christine Gulbranson, Senior Vice President for Research, Innovation, and Entrepreneurship, working in the University of California Office of the President. So let's get into this. Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for leading the cheers and welcoming our panel. So let's get into this. Tina, let's start with you. Let's just give us an overview, first of all, of what you do and what you're working on as it relates to climate change.
My contribution at the University of California is to look at communication. We're all human. We have brains. We use those brains to think, but to think, reason, make decisions, ultimately to take action or not take action in our daily lives for anything related to finding sustainable solutions, both as individuals or as groups. We need to use language, so we have to communicate to each other, to other groups, to culturally diverse groups, and find better solutions together.
And so part of that is with something called the Center for Climate Communications. What is that? Is that something you founded? What does that do?
Right. So at UC Merced, the 10th UC campus, I founded the Center for Climate Communication. So the mission or the goal of that is to promote and to do basic research on how humans communicate about climate-related issues. Some of the studies we do look at the effect of communicating about wildfires and wildfire safety. Wildfires, of course, is a huge problem in the West. And one of the reasons for it is because of climate changes that we're seeing. So we also do a number of studies on risk and how to best frame risk, talking about short-term issues versus long-term issues related about climate changes. And we also look at metaphor and how metaphor influences the way we think and reason about climate change. Metaphor is really good at taking complex or abstract information and making it clear.
Can you give an example of how a metaphor that has been used to talk about climate change that allowed to break through some communication barriers?
One trend that we're seeing in talking about climate change, and we see it in other things too, it might be in how we talk about cancer or all sorts of issues or problems in the world, is a journey metaphor. So think about everyday communication. We often talk about journeys towards solutions. So like on the path towards recovery, on the path towards solutions, or working together, moving along the path, we're moving forward, and these sorts of things. That's a very effective way to get groups to buy into thinking about a particular way of thinking about something or doing something. So that's one metaphor that's being used a lot in discourse, everyday informal discourse about climate changes. Another one that we're seeing is battle metaphors, of course. So talking about climate change as a battle, the war against climate change. But we're also seeing that metaphor used a lot in the discourse about discrepancies or miscommunication about climate change and the politicization of these issues. So a lot of the focus goes into that as well, and a lot of that is around framed in terms of a battle metaphor.
Bill McKibben had a terrific article in the very recent New Republic about how climate change is in some ways the equivalent of World War III, and that we need to mobilize for World War III in the same way we, America, mobilized for World War II. So there is that battle metaphor really is starting to come into the fore. Mm-hmm. But I would imagine that one of the challenges here with climate change in particular is that it's so abstract to most people. It's not like water pollution where you can, you know, see it or taste it or you get sick right away or something, that it's out there and it's years hence and it's maybe not my generation but the next generation's problem. And mm-hmm. and I would imagine that that's a big barrier to the language.
Right, it is. And so, yes, that's another facet of this as well. So is it best to talk about issues or problems that are with us right now or 5 years from now or 150 years from now? Some of the framing out there in the popular media will say things like, if we don't do X, you know, our grandchildren will suffer, or this sort of thing. That may be that may work well in certain contexts or for certain problems, but it may not always work well. It may be best to frame things in the present tense, the issues that we're facing right now, the health risks, and so on.
Great. Well, we'll come back. Lots more to talk about there, but let's move on to Dan. Dan, give us, I gave you your credentials, or at least some of your credentials. Talk a little about how you spend your time at Berkeley on climate change.
Well, I'm a physicist by training, and what I've focused my laboratory on is really looking at how you can marshal the different emerging technologies, policies, behavioral tools to create what we like to call solution science. So trying to understand how do you integrate together the emerging solar technologies with energy storage technologies, new mechanisms in the market, be it cap and trade like California has, or some of the European mechanisms, something called the feed-in tariff, a different way to support renewables as they get to cost parity with fossil fuels, something they've actually just about hit in many places today. So we build models at the level of individual behavior of households to the entire power system of Western North America, Nicaragua, Kenya, China, various systems that are key either because of their size or because they're about to embark on making a number of decisions that will either lock them into a dirty path for decades to come because of how long the infrastructure often survives in the energy field, to places that are just simply critical because they're so big. North America, China, we're working on a model for India right now with partners in country so that we can look at what the different options would be, what the costs would be. And our lab really focuses on trying to build those analytic tools to do real field programs. We just came back from two parallel campaigns, one in East Africa where they're debating new coal plants and at the same time debating large wind farms and solar facilities, and Malaysian Borneo, where there's a different kind of debate. They're calling all their options clean, from building huge hydroelectric dams that would flood large amounts of forest to more distributed small-scale systems. And we're working with the Senate there, the chief minister for the Malaysian state of Sarawak, on what are the actual issues involved in not choosing a big dam, but choosing a very distributed system of smaller solutions. And actually, the chief minister just revoked the contract for the next billion-dollar dam. And so sometimes you actually see successes. But it took a lot of work, NGO partners, sort of activist groups in the field, our group doing a lot of analysis, and a huge amount of backstory with members of utilities, the investment sector, to pull it all together. And so we use the technical part to start, but it's a bigger conversation to make it happen.
So you're a physicist who is influencing policy by way of science.
That's what we try to do.
Right. Well, and it works better in some countries than others. But I would imagine that how does a country like in Borneo, how do they come to the University of California for, and how do you get involved with that?
Well, we actually get calls out of the blue. In fact, we're often called the laboratory of lost causes because we got a call from the neighboring Malaysian state, Sabah, the former British North Borneo, and they called us up and said, we have this problem. We have a coal plant that we would prefer not to build. Can you do some analysis? And I said, well, when is it due? I said, well, they actually decided last year to build it, and they paid China 10% down payment. I said, this sounds a little late in the game. But in fact, with doing some analysis, with working with the same set of groups, they were willing to reverse their decision. And so every now and then they work out well. And sometimes it's that kind of a nice, clean story. In other cases, it's a much more complex issue, like dealing with the Keystone Pipeline in the United States, where there's a fairly clear environmental message that it's not a good feature, but there's a huge number of jobs and other economic stories that you have to work on. So we try to do the science and the engineering as cleanly as we can and then use that in the broader policy analysis.
Yeah. Well, I know that that a lot of the work that you and your team and students have done has been focused on the state of California and the and sort of where we are in AB 32 and cap and trade and the a number of other initiatives, low carbon fuel standard. Do you want to sort of give a few minutes on just on where we are with some of that, or what the role you've played and how you see has been a factor?
Well, it's definitely a broad issue where University of California system, colleagues at Stanford, Caltech, a lot of the think tanks in California have provided a huge amount of analysis, both long-term studies of the climate change that we already see going on in the West and what are the costs of the costs and benefits of the alternatives. And so our lab, as you said, has been involved. I arrived in California as an academic while we were still dealing with the fallout of the deregulation effort in the late 90s, worked on Assembly Bill 32, and actually I got the honor to be the person who was the witness for SB 32. And SB 32 that was just passed last week to great fanfare basically took our climate policies that were bringing California's emissions back down to the 1990 levels. That's the baseline year. And we were about 20% above that when we started. It's something that we will hit by 2020 and then go from 2020 to 2030. And the really exciting story is that California has today, due to all these players, a cap and trade system in place, regulations in each of the areas, in transportation, in electricity. We're starting to work on behavior. This is really where Tini comes in to think about how you communicate the benefits of that. But California's got a system in place that has survived some pretty serious threats. The biggest threat to going from AB 32 to SB 32 was a really big, large pushback with a lot of out-of-state money. The California Chamber of Commerce played, I think, a very unhelpful role in some disinformation. And before that, California voters, everyone in the room and listening in, voted down Proposition 23, designed to undo 32 by a pretty hefty, almost a 60-40 margin, to preserve California's climate leadership, to take advantage of the fact that California has actually become not just the national, but really the global go-to place for venture capital money, for new startups, the kind of companies that are populated all of South San Francisco in this clean tech space. And so we're benefiting climate-wise, but also we have an hugely exciting sort of ecosystem of companies all hiring people. The solar industry in California now out hires the entire utility industry in the state.
Yeah, the solar industry has more employees than Apple, Google, Facebook, and Twitter combined by a significant amount, I think. Yeah. Great. Well, we'll come back to some of that, but let's move on to Christine Gulbranson. Christine, you're the newest member of the UC family. Talk a little bit about what you're doing and what your plans are.
I am. So President Napolitano has charged me with leading system-wide efforts on research, innovation, and entrepreneurship. It's interesting. If you would have asked like 10 years ago, you ask campus presidents across the nation, who's your lead on innovation and entrepreneurship, you probably would have gotten kind of this funny look, right? But nowadays, I think if you ask them, at least 50% would say, yeah, I know who that lead is on my campus, and I have their cell phone number. So really looking at, you know, how do we take the wealth of technologies within our UC system, 10 campuses, 5 medical centers, and 3 managed national laboratories, and look at them to facilitate getting them out into the marketplace for the betterment of society. UC produces on average 5 inventions a day, with many of those in the clean energy space. And as you know, California is one of the most energy efficient economies in the world, only second to Germany in renewable power generation. And as Joel mentioned about UC President Napolitano's carbon neutrality initiative, UC is committed to achieving net zero greenhouse gas emission by 2025 across all 10 campuses. And so when you look at this, this creates like living labs to identify scalable and relevant solutions, not only nationally, but globally. And so we're really looking at, you know, under this new umbrella of research, innovation, entrepreneurship, how do we build that strong entrepreneurial ecosystem within and throughout the 10 campuses and leverage interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary approaches to solving these very large, challenging problems? And how do we catalyze a culture that prioritizes innovation and entrepreneurship? And then, as we mentioned from Dan, how do people reach you? How do, you know, these global countries call you? So how do we elevate that brand so people know, hey, we're open for business, we're working on these things, and give us a call and we'll help you solve a lot of your problems.
And how much of that is based on sort of pushing out innovations that are born in the university system versus pulling, like finding out what's needed and then going in and figuring out how to solve problems that companies or other investors or others actually have?
So exactly. If you look at a lot of the technology, sometimes you have one piece of a portfolio, so to speak, of technology. But if you look at other components or parts within the other campuses, you can say, hey, wait, now if we pull this technology, put that together and build a portfolio around it, we could probably solve this challenge. And I think it's really, you know, it's always good to have technology pulled out, right? And you look at the needs of what the market is looking for and challenges, and then coming in and saying, well, you have something similar to that. Can this be tweaked and maybe solve this problem? So I think it really is good to have a dynamic partnership, and that's about building that ecosystem that helps to facilitate that with corporates, philanthropists, venture capitalists, and a lot of our alumni, which actually we have approximately 1.7 million living alumni right now from UC. So do we have any UC alums out in the audience? Woohoo! Yay! That's great.
Great. Well, let's take a pause and a word from our sponsor right now, right,
Anne? You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Anne Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Membership, Member-Led Forum, and our program tonight is the University of California, Confronting Climate Change and Leading the World on a Sustainable and Environmental Path. And we have our distinguished panel members with you, with us tonight. I'd like to also remember for you that last year, the Sierra Club announced the 10 most exemplary environmental colleges and universities in the United States. Out of the 10, 4 were from the University of California system. So the University of California system has really done wonderful things for all of us, and I'm very grateful personally for all the work that goes on. But I think that's quite extraordinary to have four of the 10 be recognized by the Sierra Club. And you know, they're pretty tough customers about what they have to say, so that's really a very high-level commendation for your program. So we'll come back now, Joel, to you.
Great. Thank you, Anne. So I want to bring up a topic that often isn't one that's front of mind when we talk about climate change. And I think this is interesting in this context because all of you, each of you is working in an interdisciplinary fashion across different departments and campuses in some cases. And climate change is maybe the ultimate interdisciplinary challenge that we face, and it's not just a science problem, it's not just an energy problem, it's a societal problem. We're bringing together pretty much everything that we do. And I wanted to talk about the world of it's called environmental justice and climate change. So how do we make sure that those we could just keep it to the North American audience, Americans, or we talk globally as you prefer. But people at the lower end of the income and of scale are often the ones most disproportionately affected by all environmental problems, and particularly this one as we get into coastal flooding and we get into a lot of other issues that are going to affect them more than a lot of us. How some of the work that you're doing. So, Tini, just starting with you, I mean, I know that in California, almost half the state, I think, is a native Spanish, and that's not necessarily people who are poor, but the people mm-hmm. who it's a different audience than the traditional, you know, English speaking, Anglo-Saxon audience that often most communications is aimed at. And so talk a little bit about that or any other audiences that you're starting to think about how we communicate climate.
Okay, great. So if you look across the diverse cultures in California, there's a wide range of cultures, and there are actually a large number of different languages spoken. And you're right, nearly half of the people in California alone speak Spanish natively. So it's really important when we sit down at the table and we talk about solutions for climate change and how do we work towards a more sustainable environment. As University of California people and Californians at large, we all need to think carefully about the person who we're talking, whom, you know, they're on the receiving end, engage that person, make them feel like their voice is valued. And it's really, really important to know a little bit about that person's language whenever possible. So if you look at Spanish alone, the journey metaphor that I mentioned earlier, if you're using that to talk about problems and working towards solutions for problems, that's probably not the most effective metaphor for a lot of Spanish speakers. If you're talking about medical issues or something that's negative, the journey metaphor tends to be something that's viewed as positive. So there's kind of a mismatch there. Whereas for those of us who speak English natively, that's a fine metaphor to use, you know, if we're talking about negative or positive things. So our basic ways of thinking and the ways that we talk about this will vary across cultures, and it's important to, at the very least, be mindful of that. And then when it is possible, bring in experts, i.e. native speakers of those languages, to help frame those messages and teach us how to engage with speakers of other languages or people from diverse backgrounds, whether it's different social classes and so on.
Are there, I would imagine that there's some of the languages where even talking different views or cultures, really, the different views of the future, how you talk about the future, or whether even, I guess, future tense is it plays a role.
Right.
How does that factor in, and what should we be, what are you learning about what we should be doing differently?
Okay, so, yeah, good question. So in English, we have a number of modal auxiliaries. That's a fancy term for words like would, could, might, should, and so on. And we use these a lot in everyday English when we're talking about climate change and other issues to talk about uncertainty. So we can say CO2 levels may reach this amount by X, or we may be able to lower such and such by this date. So we can use these words which allow us to hedge a little bit, and they convey different degrees of uncertainty. So a lot of languages don't have those. So Spanish, for example, they don't have modal auxiliaries, at least not the rich, nuanced system that we have in English. So we English speakers can talk about uncertainty in this very nuanced kind of way when it comes to talking about now or the future. Other languages may not have that. That doesn't mean that they don't have the concept for uncertainty. It just means we have to think carefully about different ways of conveying that information.
Dan, we mentioned SB 32, that the bill that Governor Brown signed just not that many days ago, that has some new mechanisms for bringing climate solutions and mechanisms for to low income communities. Talk a little bit about what you see going on there, and what the University of California, how you're thinking about it helping advance that.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting time because over the last few years, equity and inequality has become a major topic of research and one of the places where academics across many disciplines around the country and definitely in the UC system have made it a focus of the kind of research to activism frontier. And so you're seeing lots and lots of centers, lots of programs focused around this. And when Assembly Bill 32 was passed a decade ago, it wasn't absent, but getting it through the first time, it was really the first of its kind piece of legislation to have this target to bring our emissions down, kind of bend the curve. That was new enough that the attention was really on those numbers, and it wasn't on the broader social issues and the distributional impacts of those policies. SB 32 now, and ironically, it was called AB 32 because then it was enter Assembly Member Fran Pavley, who was the author, and now it's SB 32 because now that she's in the Senate, and it's Senate Bill 32. So there's a nice progression there. Fran, who was a primary school teacher for 29 years before joining the California government, got lots of input from my group and many others about different mechanisms you can use. And so SB 32 is now quite rich in the requirement that you look at distributional impacts. If you think about a project that is going to be in the Central Valley, you look at the air quality benefits for those most impacted individuals. In fact, of our cap and trade program, over 50% of the monies from that actually go to disadvantaged communities. And that's a huge step forward from how we were thinking a decade ago. And so there's lots of very tangible places where the distribution of impacts across different communities is now part of the conversation. Doesn't mean we always do it right. And there's lots of issues about inner city California communities. There are trans-border issues with Mexico. There's lots of areas to do more work. But it's become central to the dialogue. And I guess the last nice feature is that the federal, it's not quite a scale-up of California, but the Clean Power Plan, President Obama's plan to give each state a target to reduce their emissions by about a third, actually has carved out about $8 billion in that program to work for and with disadvantaged communities and to help retrain communities that need to move out of traditional fossil fuel industries. And so you're seeing a federal level of something that was really started and highlighted here.
Mm-hmm. Christine, you're early on in your tenure in the president's office, but is there a view of how we can help those at the lower ends of the economic spectrum and use innovation through the UC system? Is that part of the conversation?
Definitely. I think there's a lot of technologies that can be used in society from an educational standpoint, from utilization standpoint. I've just recently finished my tours of all 10 campuses, and being able to go into some of the incubators and accelerators that we have on our campuses and adjacent to our campuses, and looking at the wealth of technology and thinking, oh my goodness, wow, if we brought that out, there's so many people today that could be utilizing these technologies. It's amazing. It really, really, just I was amazed at all the different things that I've been seeing.
I know that the Haas School has the Global Social Venture Competition. I've had the pleasure of being one of the judges for several years, and they're looking at business school students from all over the world because it's collaborated with a number of different universities around the world, bringing fairly simple ideas. There was one winner one year that was just a SMS thing that allowed you to find out when the water was coming on in India because the water wasn't always on and people stayed home all day waiting for the water to come on. And if you knew when it was coming on or if it was supposed to come on and didn't come on, and you can then tell someone. But are there problem sets that you that maybe simple solutions that you are starting to think about now that maybe that the university can start to address?
Well, I think, you know, actually, so you mentioned that competition. There's also the Big Ideas competition, also that stemmed out of Berkeley, and I think it's coming up on its 10-year anniversary, and looking at social impact type of technologies. And I think one of them that I recently saw was like the solar-powered lantern that they've been using in third world countries. It's those type of, you know, simple things that we would consider simple here, right? But it's so impactful in a third world country that it's those type of things that really are just amazingly impactful that really change the world and bend the universe, so to speak.
Dan, were you going to say something?
No, I'm good.
No, okay. I'm curious how some of the innovations that, just sticking with you, Christine, for a second, how do you see scaling them up? Because one of the, you know, we have, this is the hub of innovation here in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley, and a lot of those go through this valley of death where they don't get the funding. And do you see a pathway that a university can play a role that perhaps the venture capital community or some of the other incubators can't as well in terms of advancing and getting these things out to market?
Well, I think, you know, as I've spoken over my career with very large Fortune 50 companies, and they're really looking at, they no longer can do long-term R&D, so to speak, right? And so they are looking, you know, where can they find technologies? And I think that's where a university can look very long-term, can take the risk of developing different types of technologies. But to that point of how do you get them out kind of into the marketplace, so just to give you a study that was done by Crunchbase in 2013, since 1920, UC Berkeley is the third in the nation at providing successful entrepreneurs, only third to Stanford and Harvard. And there are multitude of, I was looking up, you know, different technologies and different startup companies that have come as a result of that. So one is CalWave, which is working on ocean wave energy converter to harness renewable power of ocean waves to produce electricity and fresh water. And they've been a finalist in the DOE Wave Energy and Prize. And one of the founders was named Forbes 30 Under 30 Innovator. And they're currently in the proof of concept stage. So that's kind of a little early on. Then you have Imprint Energy, which is developing zinc-based rechargeable batteries that are ultra-thin and flexible for Internet of Things. And the founders were awarded an SBIR funding, and they also have raised a Series A. And total between SBIR and Series A is $7 million. And they were listed in MIT Tech Review as one of the 50 smartest companies in 2015. So a little bit, you know, later stage there. And one that I always found really quite fascinating, when I was down at UC San Diego, there's one faculty member that's actually making surfboards out of algae.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you know about that one.
Yeah.
That was very interesting. And then you have UC Davis's Clean World Partners, and they're using anaerobic digester technologies for agriculture and organic waste remediation, and they produce biofuels as a product of that. And they have $2 million in revenue and 13 employees. So that kind of gives you the scope of very early stage, kind of middle stage, and now to revenue generation and employees.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, Tini, I mentioned one of the really important pieces of work, God's work, if you will, that is possible for the likes of you is getting scientists to be able to communicate. Because the University of California system, but every university, you know, has some great research being done on climate and other topics. And the ability to talk about those outside of the scientific community is often not there. Now, not everybody is, you know, is a Dr. Dan Kamen, who has this gift of being able to talk to audiences in plain English. How do you help, or do you see a role in trying to help them do that?
Yeah, so the University of California, I think across the system, is beginning to be more aware of the problems of teaching scientists just to do science or engineers just to do engineering. That's only part of the solution that we're looking at, the global solution. In our Center for Climate Communication, we have these really interesting and fruitful events where we invite farmers to the campus, and they sit down and have lunch with some graduate students, faculty, staff people at our campus, and sometimes other campuses visit as well. And we talk about important issues like drought and challenges for agriculture and farming and so on. And this is great training for the graduate students who attend these sorts of events, because right there they learn how important it really is to be able to talk to the general public and to people who are, you know, literally doing hands-on work with these problems with farmers and other stakeholders. So I think that's one important thing that we already are doing, and in UC to some extent, is teaching our graduate students and undergrads how the importance of not just communicating science to other scientists, but communicating science well and in engineering as well to the general public and to diverse stakeholders.
But do you think that the scientists understand? There's an issue we talk about in my company around framing issues. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you frame these complex, incredibly complex science about which there's lack of agreement in many cases for journalists, for other educators, let alone for students and the public?
So one way you do that is through interdisciplinary work. So people like the three of us, or, you know, graduate students with other graduate students, it often requires multiple people working on one project or communicating one sort of message. Another way to do it is with metaphor, as I've already mentioned, trying to put complex words into a form of a metaphor that can really help communicate to children, to adults of all sorts of backgrounds. And then also, just being clear in your message, you know, instead of using jargon, try to make the message clear. Going back to these very basic Strunk and White kinds of things, you know, why use a low-frequency word that has a very specific meaning when you can just as easily use an everyday word to explain the same sort of thing?
Can you give an example of that?
Oh, boy. Let's see. Dan could probably give a good example, I guess.
Because clearly I use too many of those acronyms and things. I mean, I think one of the big challenges is that we have a whole bunch of different mechanisms that have been used to support renewable energy, solar and wind in particular, as they went from being not directly cost competitive to cost competitive. And the mechanisms are complex in their individual details. We talk about feed-in tariffs and RPSs and all of these terms, as opposed to simply saying, this is a price subsidy for a technology we want to compete. And what do you do to give it a little bit of a boost, but then have a sunset so that subsidy goes away, so they're market competitive? And actually, at the Clean Energy Ministerial, the global gathering of leaders that took place in San Francisco this June, it was interesting because the cheapest energy projects installed anywhere in the world, without subsidy, just the pure numbers, were solar and wind projects in the U.S., Mexico and Czechoslovakia. And those were the winners just on simple price. No footnotes about what was the subsidy, this and that. And half of the leaders in the room didn't know that renewable energy projects had outcompeted their fossil competitors, just, you know, no backstory. And so I think that's an example of an area totally full of jargon, but there's a real simple way to say where we've gotten to today.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. And our program this evening is the Commonwealth Club of California. And our program tonight is University of California Confronting Climate Change and Leading the World on a Sustainable and Environmental Path, with our distinguished panel discussion. I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources, a member-led forum. And again, back to you, Joel. It is time, by the way, for us to answer our question cards. So we'll move forward with our question cards and see what our questions have been and what kinds of responses are available for us to solve all the problems we need to solve. Joel?
Yeah, we've got a lot of great questions here.
There are a lot of great questions.
One of them, actually, Christine, I'll start with you on this, or have you field this one. It's actually talking about who are the greenest campuses in the UC system, and that UC Irving is in the top 10 and UC Davis is a perennial member. What's holding other campuses back? Let's go beyond greening to sort of innovation. In terms of let me reframe it a little bit into what are some of the qualities on the campuses that you just came back from visiting them that you think are essential that may not be universally met, Div? No.
I think all of our campuses are striving.
You love all of your children.
Yes, very much so. I think even looking at it. Each of them, I think, are addressing it in certain ways. When I was at San Diego, they had a fleet of vehicles that they were using, some hybrid, some electric, really trying to change that dynamic to meet the carbon neutrality initiative that we've set for all 10 of our campuses. So I think, yes, some obviously have won awards and are a little bit more far along, but all of them find this as what they are striving for, and it's becoming part of the DNA, if it's not already in the DNA.
Thank you for fielding that. Well, let's stick with you, Christine, and try another one. It says that UC is the only university that signed the Breakthrough Energy Coalition pledge that was led by Bill Gates and a bunch of others. How much and how and when will UC start investing in early stage Series A, seed stage energy and climate related tech startups? So is there a fund that the university is actually investing in these companies?
So with respect to the Breakthrough Coalition, I'm not as up to speed on that. We do have a fund for UC investment that we're an LP in that fund that basically is looking at early stage technologies. Exactly. Right. Yes, thank you. Looking at early stage technologies that are coming out of the UC system to invest in.
Tini Matlock, you mentioned a couple of things that don't work. What metaphors resonate with the Hispanic community to influence behavior change to address climate change?
Well, that's a great question. I did mention a few words about the journey metaphor earlier, right? And I suggested that one may not always work for negative information. And then I did mention a battle or a war metaphor. I'll just call it a battle metaphor for simplicity. That seems to be, I wouldn't want to say a universal metaphor, because then I'd be talking about 7,000 and some languages in the world, and I don't know facts about metaphor in all 7,000 languages. But in all the languages I do know a bit about and that I've studied, that seems to be a very pervasive metaphor. All humans know about fighting and war and winning and losing and taking sides and these sorts of things. So in Spanish, that does seem to be a deeply entrenched metaphor that helps people think about things and helps people to form opinions and be unified and take sides and that sort of thing.
Great. This, I think, is for Dan. Did you pass out something that had graphs on it, Dan? Was that your document?
I did pass out something, no graph. There's a table. It's over on the side for those who want it.
Let's assume that graph equals table in this question. Looking at the table from the document passed out, how come, is this animal agronomy or agriculture?
Agronomy,
here it is. Isn't listed. Isn't this a growing issue as well? And can you speak a little bit on this?
Yeah, so the table for those kind of listening on the radio is just highlighting where California's greenhouse gas emissions come from, and we're actually dominated now by emissions in transportation. It's almost 40% of our total emissions in that sector. The industrial sector is next to 24%, and actually a lot of the agronomy and agriculture is in those two categories, both transportation and then in our industrial activities. And what's interesting about California's greenhouse gas policy is that it started out thinking that decarbonizing electricity was going to be kind of the game. and you think about coal-fired power plants and diesel plants, and so it makes sense. But because California has been pushing for so long to clean up that sector, it's actually quite clean right now. It's one of the cleanest in the world. And so deploying more solar or wind is always a good thing, but the marginal benefit for our overall portfolio is getting smaller and smaller until we find ways to cross modes. And that's one of the questions that Tini brought up about interdisciplinary teams. So a great example of that is that if you push into electric vehicles or fuel cell vehicles powered with green hydrogen, you're getting two bites of the apple, to use the agricultural metaphor, I guess. And that is, you get clean electricity, but then you get clean transportation. And developing policies that support both of those means working across what's going on in electricity with our utilities and what's going on with our transportation system, and then how do we give credit for stored energy. And I suspect many people in the room have solar on their rooftops, but some of them may be frustrated that you can install as much solar as you want, but unless you live in certain parts of Southern California or you have an old enough system that's grandfathered, you can't make money by selling power back. That seems like a very strange barrier, because if you solarize your roof, home, or business, why not put the power back into the system?
So what's the animal agronomy piece of that? Is it pigs?
Look, it's gonna, yeah, so it comes up because one of our areas of significant emissions is from all the animals. So cows farting is part of the story, and we track all of these features. But unless you want to put a bag on the butt of every cow, it's a bit challenging to deal with. And so what do you do? So the state has developed programs to work with dairies and to work with farmers that previously were burning their rubbish to give them credits for doing other things. And so that's an opportunity area that was not seen as a big deal 10 years ago, but now that we've cleaned other parts of the system quite a bit, it's now come into the forefront. And so we're seeing all kinds of interesting examples of what are some of the opportunities to take animal waste or agricultural waste, make it into electricity, to put it back into those power plants and put it back into the grid. That's a classic California kind of solution science. That's putting together things from very different areas. And it's something that we already see huge challenges in parts of Latin America and Africa and elsewhere. And so we're seeing many of the companies that are being discussed here now looking at those overseas markets as bigger than they're going to do in California. And so that global reach of this kind of innovation ecosystem is really critical.
So, Tini, Dan used an expression a few minutes ago about a bag that I think tried to take complex language around methane emissions and greenhouse gas and the impact in climate change down to a level that I think everybody can understand. What is the opportunity to be able, and how far can you go? Can you go too far in talking about some of these things that all of a sudden does no longer resonates, or you just dumb it down too much? Is there a happy medium in there?
I think, again, that's where it depends on the person you're talking to and the group and so on, what language background, what level of education, what the goal of that interaction is. And the only way that can be ascertained in some cases is by trying to establish common ground with that person. And that's where language can really influence reasoning. So if I come up and start talking to one of you audience members, I may not know a thing about you. What is your native language? What's your expertise? What kind of profession do you have? That sort of thing. But through talking to you, I can find out more. And then I can frame what I'm saying to you in a particular way, and you can do the same back to me, and then we can connect. So I think it depends a lot on the audience, who you're talking to.
Yeah, how much they know and how much they care and all of that.
Yeah, and then part of that is being mindful of that. When you go into the conversation, don't always assume that you have the right way of framing things. You have to talk to another person and be flexible in the way you're talking about things.
Right. Christine, somebody asked, given the tremendous number of technologies and ideas in the UC system, how do you organize or keep track of them in order to create the potential synergies of bringing them together? And they said parenthetically, if you have a system, can I access it? Smiley face. But I guess what that really gets to is the fact that often these things are synergies of technologies, and 1 + 1 = 11 at some point if you do it right. And also, some of these things aren't necessarily obvious climate solutions, but applied or deployed in the right way may bring a series of benefits that even the inventor didn't necessarily see. So what's your approach? How do you sort of connect those dots?
Looking at it with a certain lens. Right, to look at those different technologies. One of the things that I actually want to deploy that we're looking at is to identify what type of IT tools and resources we can utilize from a system-wide perspective. So, of course, we have portals to our patents, but again, looking at how do we kind of matchmake and pair those for information opportunity distribution, networking, and community building as well. How do we engage folks that would be interested in those technologies? So trying to look from that IT background, infrastructure perspective, we are looking at that right now. As I'm new to this role, I am looking at that because I really think that's what we need to help gather and harness that information, because you're right, we could have one technology over here at, say, UC Merced, and another technology over at UC San Diego that's kind of similar, but complementary, right, in the sense of it solves this one problem we're looking for. And then who would even think that maybe over here at Santa Barbara, another technology we could bring in. So understanding where all those different technologies lie, and then being able to look from that lens of, okay, so the 30,000-foot level, how can we move the pieces of the puzzle together that actually could solve some of these very large climate change problems?
Dan, I imagine you see some of that. And I imagine there's also cases where some of the students and postdocs that work with you don't fully grasp the potential of what they've come up with or what they're looking at in terms of its applicability. It's maybe they started maybe with what they thought was a small or medium-sized solution. It actually has a bigger lens or bigger impact.
It's definitely true. I mean, we've had a number of students work in particular on solar and storage and be thinking about it as a research question, kind of chasing numbers like what's the most efficient solar cell? And in conversation with people in the private sector, they'll often be told things like, I don't really care if it's the most efficient cell if the way you get that is more expense. Because for most of us, rooftop area is not the limiting factor. And you need a super efficient cell if you only have a tiny amount of rooftop to deal with. And a less efficient cell at a lower cost or using a cheaper material. So one of my students actually shared with the former director of Lawrence Berkeley Lab, Paul Alvasatos. He did a study of all of the different solar materials and concluded that unlike silicon and various things we normally think of, actually pyrite, fool's gold, it was an ideal choice because it's incredibly common, incredibly cheap to mine, and you can have a low efficiency but very low cost solar cell. So he went on from doing that as his PhD to writing a paper that's been used in over 200 patents as of today. And he just finished a time working at what's called ARPA-E, which is basically the Department of Energy's $400 million a year innovation accelerator, where you put together teams around different products. And I don't think when he started at all, he was thinking that he would kind of go so much into the private sector. He's now head of sustainability for Nike. So that was a pretty interesting succession. And I don't want to speak for him totally, but I don't think he planned that route at all.
Right. That's Cyrus, right?
Cyrus Wadia, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Dan, here's that question I'm going to let you take, which is that is the UC system working on reducing the energy use through changes in transportation?
Yeah, so I would say that's the big area right now. You heard that transportation is almost 40% of our state emissions, and there's very different strategies. 10 years ago, I would have answered that question by saying the biggest bulk of researchers who weren't working on vehicle efficiency, which you always want to have in the system, were thinking about biofuels. In fact, I went on 60 Minutes to talk about the debate around biofuels. It is largely the bloom is off that rose because of all of the different land use impacts. And we're now seeing much larger pushes into how do we electrify our vehicles? How do we shift us out of individual cars to mass transit? How do you take advantage of the upside of the car sharing and other features to just limit the number of vehicles you need per urban area? And all of the campuses have programs in those areas. Fascinating patents on hardware, but I think the big frontier today might be more and more campuses across the system are working on the behavioral side. And what are the policies and what are the incentives to change behavior, not just think this is a hardware solution?
Mm-hmm. Dini, have you worked in that area with the sort of behaving, how language affects behavior in things like transportation choices?
I haven't looked at transportation yet, but I'm on a grant with Dan, actually, to look at energy use and people's perceptions of that and ways of communicating about it. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine doing similar kind of work with transportation per se as well. There it may be a matter of talking about losses and gains and that kind of thing and framing that sort of information.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Our program tonight is the University of California, Confronting Climate Change and Leading the World on a Sustainable and Environmental Path. Unfortunately, we've come to that point in our program tonight, which we have time for one last question. And I know whatever the one last question is, each of our panelists tonight will want to respond to that question. So we will start again with you, Joel, and let's hear what our one last question is.
So I have one last question. When the four of us meet back here at the Commonwealth Club in 2018 to talk about the University of California and its role in climate change, what's the story each of you would like to be able to tell? Dean, I'll start with you.
I'd like to be able to say two things, and they're both about education. I'd like to be able to say that all undergraduates in the University of California, and this is starting to happen now, but maybe by then it'll be fully achieved, that they'll have a much better understanding of the social impact they can have through communication with finding sustainable solutions and working together, a good, solid, interdisciplinary understanding of how this works, and then have the skill set to be able to talk about it and work together. And then the other part of that is children in our state, educating our students, graduate students, and undergraduates as well, to work with kids in schools and with educators across the state, whether it's the Bay Area, Southern California, San Joaquin Valley, finding much better ways to communicate about climate issues to the children in California as well. That's extremely important, and there hasn't, in my opinion, been enough work done there. Again, University of California is starting to do it, but we all have a lot of legwork to do ahead of us to make it happen.
Dan Kamen, what's the story you'd like to be able to tell?
So Tini took the broad education one, so I'll get much more focused since 2018 is not that far away, and this is a long battle. This is definitely the marathon, not a sprint. So what I actually hope is that the people who are not students in the room learn from the debate the students are doing, and that is right now the discussion about why we don't have carbon pricing, whether it's cap and trade or carbon tax, isn't much more widely discussed, and why places like the University of California haven't instituted their own internal carbon pricing so that we can actually assess what are the costs and benefits. And right now we're flying a little bit blind, in my view. We don't always know what is the carbon impact of decisions we make, from buying hardware to investment to divestment. And it's a place I would argue the students are way ahead of their older friends, colleagues, peers, and parents.
Christine.
I'll take it from the innovation and entrepreneurship lens. UC as an alumna has instilled so much confidence in me to solve a lot of these problems as a physicist, as an engineer. Yogi Berra said, baseball is 90% mental and the other half physical. Well, I think entrepreneurship is 90% confidence and the other half execution. So one of my goals is to make sure that every person affiliated with the UC system has the confidence to go out and execute to solve these large climate problems. And another one would also be to look at a lot of these technologies and research that's currently being developed and seeing them out being utilized in the marketplace.
Well, that's pretty good, considering you didn't know I was going to ask that question. I think you all did a really terrific job. In fact, I think you've all done a really terrific job. Please join me in thanking our panel, Christine, Daniel.
As I'm chair of the Environmental Natural Resources Forum, I actually get to ask the last question. So I'll ask each of our panelists a short question. And that is probably the hardest question. What do you think our biggest challenge, our single biggest challenge is as we sit here today. So we'll ask for maybe a one or two sentence answer, and we'll start. Do you want to start with you, Joel?
I thought I was the one that gets to ask the questions. The biggest challenge in climate change?
In our environmental efforts.
Well, as a communicator, I think that in the notion that when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, I do think that a lot of these things are communications challenges, that we have to learn how to explain it, how to talk about it, and how to talk to one another as friend to friend, parent, child, teacher, student, shopkeeper to customer. And I think being able to have those conversations is really critical to everything we get to do moving forward.
I think one of the biggest challenges relates to the politicization of this problem at large. A lot of time in a day, in a week, in a month, in a year goes to who's wrong, who's right, what happened in the past, what side we want to take now, and this kind of thing. And talking about science as if it's some magical, mysterious sort of thing, and, you know, it's really bizarre, and it's a hard problem. If we could all just start focusing on working together on this problem, everyone in his or her own particular way, communicating, working together, we can do something to change it. But it makes it much, much harder when we politicize things. And that's true of both sides, I would say. It's not good to have extreme beliefs.
I think the biggest challenge from my perspective is that California is less than 2% of global emissions. And even if we had a wonderful policy mechanism and never made missteps, things would never happen here. Solving the problem inside our borders wouldn't do anything unless there's a huge amount of follow-on and partnership. So I would say it's California's foreign policy. And that's difficult because the money for it comes from in-state things. So there's always an incentive. If you're not spending the money in California, it's not being spent well. Well, we have to partner around the Western United States, around the world, and that's always going to be a challenge for any pocketbook, no matter how you're doing. And I think that's the big issue for us. We have to go global right away.
I think it's changing behaviors, not only locally but globally, because when you look and if you take the research and the data that we're gathering in the space and you look and you say, okay, so if you change your behavior, then this number would go down. I think when people can see it and put it in that context, that maybe they might change to a more efficient standpoint for more energy efficiency.
Thank you so much. And for our audience, let's give a big round of applause for our panel. To Joel Machauer, who's chairman and executive editor of Green Biz Group, thank you for being our moderator, and thank you for guiding us through this wonderful discussion. To Christine Gulbranson, Senior Vice President for Research in the USIS. Is that right, Christine? I got that wrong.
Gulbranson,
thank you. Senior Vice President for Research, UC System. Daniel
Kamen.
Distinguished Professor of Energy, UC Berkeley. And Tini Matlock, McClatchy Chair of Communications, UC Merced. So for each of them for coming tonight and being with us, another big round of applause. And a special thank you to our audience tonight and for your wonderful questions, and to all of those who are listening to our program tonight. Thank you very, very much. We really appreciate it. And if you want to look for more environmental and natural resources programs, look at commonwealthclub.org. And finding radio, video, and podcasts, you can go to www.commonwealthclub.org and click on multimedia, or to www.commonwealthclub.org/broadcast. As you know, this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and I'm proud to be here with you tonight. And this program of the Commonwealth Club of California is now adjourned.